Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. I've been trying to preach on Sunday morning, or pardon me, on Sunday evenings for the last few times, and it's been a couple of Sunday evenings since I preached. Brother Fox preached, I believe, last Sunday evening, and then I was sick a Sunday evening, so I haven't been real regular. It's not like these messages have followed one right on the tail of another. But I've had some young parents that have said it would really help us if we could hear some preaching on raising children. And so we've been doing some of that. And tonight I want to take you to just one verse out of Ephesians. You know, we always are talking about children, obey your parents. Children, obey your parents. Children, obey your parents. And sometimes that's kind of a one-way street. But the Apostle Paul was not just a one-way street kind of guy. Paul was a man full of balance. And he said, yeah, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, that it may be well with you and that your days may be long upon the earth. But then he turned around and he said, and you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And I want to talk to you this evening. I'm going to give you 13 things, and I've given this to you before. Some of you probably have this list in your Bible somewhere, but it never hurts to review these things. And for some of you, for several of you, this will be the first time you've heard it, but 13 things that parents do, mostly unwittingly, but we do these things and it provokes our children to wrath unnecessarily. Now, I want you to understand by the same token that every child is a seed of Adam. Every child came from Adam's sinful race, and every child has rebellion in his heart, and every child is to an extent proud and selfish, and we have to train that out of them as they grow up, and we have to teach them character. They're born without it. We have to try to teach it to them, and there are so many things that children can have blame laid at their feet for, but, you know, there's enough things that kids have to work their way through and enough things that they have to have victory over without us adding to that by provoking them to wrath, don't you see? And so as we look at this evening, I just want to give you these things. Now, you won't see these things in a text in this text. This is a list of things that I made up. Most of them I learned by realizing I was doing that. That's a woeful way to learn. When you look and realize, you know what, I just made a terrible mistake there with my kids, and I could have provoked them to wrath. If they had chosen, they could have been really angry and bitter over this. Most of these things I have done myself, or I have observed other people do. But one day I sat down and I made a list, and I tell you, this is not a conclusive list. When the service is over, if you say, Pastor, I thought of one more thing. Heidi's real good for this. I thought of one more thing that wasn't on that list. I think, as a matter of fact, the last time I preached it, it was 12 things that provoke your children to wrath, and Heidi gave me 13. I'm thinking, I don't remember. It might have been somebody else, but you feel free to walk up and say, I thought of another thing, because by the time I'm finished, I'd like this to be 20 things, and then we can preach for an hour on it, okay? Unreasonable demands, that's number one. Unreasonable demands. These are demands that are made by random choices or personal whims. Well, I knew a Christian school principal once that got it in his head. He didn't want the kids at the Christian school to wear, at that particular time, the fad that was going around was navy blue slacks with a white stripe down the side. And this Christian school principal, he got a bee in his bonnet about that. He just thought that didn't look right. And so opening day of school, he made a rule about it. Now, the parents had already gone out and spent their budget on school clothes. But it was a personal whim. And he had several sets of parents come in and talk with him and tell him, you know what, you should have told us that 3 months ago. You should have told us that in the middle of the summer. And then we wouldn't have went and bought these clothes. Now we've spent our budget. And it's not like these pants are immodest. It's not like there's a problem with them, except that you don't like them. And you know what he told me personally? He said, you know, I could be reasonable on this, but I think I'm going to be a stinker. I just think I'm going to be a stinker. Now, you know what, dads and moms, sometimes we just, you know, we could be reasonable, but there's times we just want to be a stinker and have our way. Maybe something the child is wanting to do has inconvenienced us a little bit, and it's put us out of our way a little bit, and we just really would rather not mess with it. But it's a personal whim. It's not really right or wrong. You know, I've told my kids many times when they were growing up, I said, you really didn't do anything wrong, but you were getting on my nerves. How many parents could say amen there? You've been there. Didn't really do anything wrong, but you were getting on my nerves, and I've had a belly full of it. So sit down until I tell you to get up. Unreasonable demands made by random choices. A lot of times this involves things like personal dislike or selfish inconvenience. We may use that as an excuse. Unreasonable demands would fall in this category. I remember one time when I was a child in grade school, I think I was in the fourth grade. My teacher corralled a whole bunch of us for whispering during a story that she was reading. She had a reading hour or a reading time during the day. Do you ever do that, Mrs. Euler? Do you ever read to your students a book? Okay, so it was during that time, and three or four of us were whispering. And she scolded us once, and then the whispering happened again. And without really knowing who was doing the whispering, she just assigned about six of us to write like 25,000 times, "I will not whisper during story time." And I thought, well, I got homework to do. I'm going to be writing all night. I didn't know how many, and it wasn't 25,000 times, but it was a lot of times. And you know, I got off the bus, and I showed Mother the note. The teacher sent a note home telling us what we had to do before we could come back to school the next day. And boy, so I sat down and started writing. And I wrote, my little hand cramped. I mean, I wrote for 2 or 3 hours, and my little hand cramped. And I don't know how many times. I had several notebook pages of paper filled. But finally, an hour after bedtime, Mother came in and took my paper up, and she said, "That's enough. I'll write your teacher a note back." And I don't know what she put on that note, but the teacher never said anything to me. And she accepted the number of times that I had written. But you know what came out of that? I despised that teacher. From that day forward, first of all, I had not been whispering the second time. But because I was sitting near some who did, she just shot in the dark and gave it to a whole bunch of us. See, and the amount of times that she told us to write was unreasonable. It was more than could be accomplished overnight. If I'd have stayed up all night, I could have never have reached. She just snatched a number out of the air. Those are the kind of punishments, or those are the kind of things, dads and moms, that will cause your kid to walk away and say, "You know what, that just wasn't just. I didn't have that coming. I was wrong, yes." And most kids will admit, "Yes, I was wrong, I did wrong." But when you drop an atom bomb on a mosquito, you've overkilled. And you know what you'll do? You'll cause your child's heart to be provoked to wrath unnecessarily. So let's make sure we avoid unreasonable demands. Number two, unrealistic expectations. This would be demanding teenage behavior from an adolescent and adult behavior from a teen. When Nathan was 9 years old, he was our first child. And so I had determined when I was a Bible college student that my children are not going to be like anybody else's children. My children are going to be perfect. My children are going to get away with nothing. By the time my children are 10 years old, they'll be driving cars, and by the time they're 16 years old, they'll be running the nation. You know, I mean, my kids are going to be exceptional. And I'm not putting up with any of the stuff that I see other people put up with in their kids. I'm just not doing it. And so I would send Nathan on a little errand, and I'd go in there and look, and it was just puttered over. I mean, and I'd take him back in there, and I would stand there like a drill sergeant over him. And I didn't even realize what I was doing to him. And it wasn't overnight that this happened. It was over a period of months. But it got to the point that as soon as I would tell him, and he was just 8 or 9 years old, I would tell him to go do something, and he would begin to cry. And I thought, not only can he not do anything right, now he bawls when I tell him to go do something. And my wife had the foresight to see, or the insight to see, she said, "The problem's not him, the problem's you. You're expecting a 9-year-old kid to do 15-year-old stuff. You're expecting an adolescent to be a teen. And she said, you have criticized him and criticized him and criticized him until he doesn't think there's anything he can ever do to please you, so why even try? I know before I start, I'm going to be whipped, I'm going to be doomed, I'm going to be criticized. I'd be better off not even to touch it, not even to try. Boy, it's terrible when your wife can paint such a picture and you can look and say, man, what was I thinking? And so I went to one of the men in our church who he and his wife had tried to have children but couldn't have any. And I said, Brother Jim, I need you to do me a favor. And he said, what is that? I said, I need you to help me with my son. I've made a real mistake with him. And he said, what is that? I said, well, he's 9 years old and I've tried to get him to be 15. And so anytime I ask him to do anything, he begins to cry because he knows he will never live up to my expectations. And I said, he needs to be around some other adult man who can see him as a 9-year-old child and appreciate him for the exceptional 9-year-old that he is. And Jim said, well, I can do that. He said, I would enjoy doing that. He said, when would you like me to do this? I said, would you take him and make him let him help you on your bus route? He was a bus captain. And so every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, Jim Ballingall would pick up Nathan and take him on his bus route. And they would spend a couple hours visiting the bus route. And then Jim would stop and buy Nathan a happy meal at McDonald's. And Nathan would come home just happy as all get out. And Nathan was always like that. If I took Nathan with me on visitation, every visit took twice as long because every lady looked at him and thought he was hungry. And every lady, I would take him in and sit him on the couch, and every lady would say, little boy, would you like something to eat? And he'd say, yes, ma'am. And so I'd have to wait for him to eat something else. It was a piece of cake or a sandwich or a piece of warmed over pizza or something, but he had to eat everywhere we went. But he got Jim to buy him McDonald's hamburgers for lunch on Saturdays. But you know what? He started to come out of that because somebody realized and treated him at the level that he should be treated. Now listen, it's just not logical to think that a 9-year-old is going to do things like a 16-year-old will do. But when we set unrealistic expectations for them and we try to make a 5-year-old be like a 10-year-old or a 10-year-old be like a 15-year-old, we are setting them up for nothing but frustration and failure, and they will end up, in the end, despising us for unrealistic expectations. So be careful about that. Unreasonable demands, unrealistic expectations, number 3. Unfavorable comparison to other children. This borders on partiality and favoritism. How many remember the story in the Old Testament of Jacob and Esau? You remember they were twins? Esau was born first, and Jacob came out with his hand on his heel. Remember that? On Esau's heel, like he was trying to trip him up and so he could be first. And that was actually ironic because that's the way their lives were lived. Jacob was always trying to supplant Esau. But do you remember the rest of the story? Both of them were favored children. The father, Isaac, liked Esau best, and the mother, Rebekah, liked Jacob best. And so the mother favored Jacob, and the father favored Esau, and they were never close brethren. But when you begin to compare your child to any other child, and here's the way this works. Ethan, why can't you be like Levi? Huh? Why can't you be like Levi? Levi always has his work done. Your work's never done. Levi's always dressed and ready for church. You're never ready. What do you think Ethan's going to end up feeling like toward Levi later? He's going to end up hating Levi. And you know what he's going to do? He's going to, one day, Levi will come in from hunting and he'll say, man, I'm starving. And Ethan will have some soup cooked. And he said, well, you can have a bowl of this soup if you'll give up your birthright. You see where this goes? Huh? Ethan's totally confused. You're going to need to straighten him out when you get home. My mother used to say to my sister, And please don't tell Mother I said this, but she used to say to my sister, why can't you be like Daniel? Because I always made good grades and worked hard. And, And you know, for some reason or other, Teresa loves me to this day, but I don't know why. You know, she still loves me. But I can remember feeling bad for her, because do you know how that makes a kid feel when you compare them to a brother or a sister or to another kid, you know? Why can't you be like them Schrock boys? Huh? Well, you know, I was thinking this morning when them boys were playing the piano. Where'd they go? There's one right there. The other's up there. You know, a lot of people don't know this. Every day, you heard them play the piano this morning. How many heard that? You know, they played well, didn't they? You know how they got so good? Every time they argue and fuss with each other, Mary makes them go practice the piano. Now, that's how much they argue and fuss. They, I just made that up. But, you know, listen, every child has his assets, and every child has his liabilities. Every child has his good points, and every child has his bad points. Every child has his successes, and every child has his failures. In the end, no child is better than any other child. I don't know how God does it, but if you'll be sensitive to the Spirit of God, you know what God will help you to do? He'll help you to see the individual gifts of every child that you have, and he'll help you to see the individual failures of every child that you have, and he'll help you to love them all the same. But let me tell you, if you want to drive your children and provoke your children to wrath, you hold one of them up for an example to the rest of them and say, why can't you be like him? And that unfavorable comparison will cause him eventually one day to despise you in his heart. Be careful about that. Unreasonable demands, unrealistic expectations, unfavorable comparison to other children. Here's number four, inconsistent behavior. We might call this sudden unaccountable changes in mood or behavior. How many people would say that you're married to a moody person? That's what I thought. One. I thought you know, nobody's going to raise their hand here, you know, which is testimony to the fact, you know. It's kind of like everybody that didn't raise their hand wanted to and wouldn't. You're too wise to, I know. But most every spouse thinks their spouse is fairly moody. But you know, a lot of us are moody people. We don't want to admit it, but a lot of us, if we've had a good day, we're lenient. If we've had a bad day, we're strict. Isn't that true? Doesn't it carry over? I mean, how many of you, if you've had a really bad day at work, your fuse is just a little shorter when you get home? You're going to take a little less. Inconsistent behavior will cause a problem, and the reason is because you're unpredictable. You know, boys and girls like to be able to predict how their father and mother are going to behave in public and in private. And by the way, to be consistent, the public and private behavior had better be the same. Really important here. You know what Jesus said to the Pharisees? He warned the disciples, don't be like the Pharisees. He said, whatever they bid you observe and do, that observe and do. But listen to this, do not ye after their works. Why? Two things he says, for they say and do not. And then in another place, two verses later, he says, in all their works they do for to be seen of men. They say and do not, and whatever works they do only for to be seen of men. Those are the two marks of a hypocrite, saying and not doing, and then doing only to be seen of men. And you know what? Sad to say, but there's parents like that, that are always saying, and they expect the child to rise to a higher standard than the one that they've set for themselves. And no child is ever going to do that. Unless God does something supernatural in the life of the child, occasionally you'll see God reach into a home and take a child out of a really bad home and bring that child way beyond the character of his or her parents. That happens occasionally, but that's the exception, not the rule. The rule is that usually each generation of children never reach the level of their parents. Okay? And so what I'm saying is, if all you say and you don't practice it, you teach and talk and teach and talk, you'll become known that way to your children. They'll say, you know, well, I know what Daddy says, but he doesn't do it either. Daddy says don't lie, but I've seen him lie. Daddy says don't cheat, but I've seen him cheat. Daddy says don't do this, but I've seen him do it. Or we see this sometimes. Children will see dad and mother argue and fuss all the way to church. Argue and fuss, pull into the church driveway, and all of a sudden a transformation falls over the whole household. And they walk in the front door and they see Joe Schrock back here. Good morning, Brother Joe. How are you today? And the children, oh. Because the children thought, if Joe Schrock could have heard them 15 minutes ago down the street, Joe Schrock wouldn't be smiling. Do you understand? It is very important that children see consistent behavior. These parents are one way in public and another way at home. Their private and their public lives do not match. And inconsistent behavior will provoke our children to wrath. Unreasonable demands, unrealistic expectations, unfavorable comparison to other children, inconsistent behavior. Number five, discourteous speech. Discourteous speech is speaking in rough, sometimes violent, and disrespectful tones. You know, harshness, militance, and almost an intimidation in speech. And vulgar, crude, discourteous speech. You know, here's the thing that we need to learn. We want our children to treat us with respect. But you know what the Scripture teaches about the tongue? In Proverbs 15:1, it says that a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. So why would I use grievous words on my children when a soft answer will do? Now, don't get me wrong. There are times that I have elevated my volume to get my child's attention. And I have signaled my displeasure with them by raising my voice a little bit. But violent, rude, discourteous speech and treating the child with no respect will get you nowhere in the long run. Generally speaking, that soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. So be careful about discourteous speech. This is close to an insulting speech. This is a little different in that it is painful wounds to self-image and self-respect. This would be calling children names like you little dummy, you stupid little ogre, you little pea brain. You say, well, I can't imagine talking to children like that. No, maybe you can't, but listen, there's kids hear that and worse every day of their lives. And they hear it from dad and mother. And they grow up feeling less than a total human being because of the way they've been talked to. And you say, well, now sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. Listen, you can believe that lie if you want to. And we tell kids that so that on the school playground they won't come home weeping every night because kids have called them names. But the truth of the matter is names and words cut like knives and sting like whips. And they hurt. And that kind of language, that insulting speech, calling children names will provoke them to wrath. Number seven, jesting about defects. Do you know kids with defects, any kind of a defect at all, is already intensely sensitive about that defect? When I was a kid, somehow or other, I got it in my head that I had big ears. I heard somebody one time say, yeah, you look like a taxi cab going down the street with both doors open. And I was so sensitive about my ears that I went home literally one night and tried taping them to the side of my head to go to bed. Somebody told me that, you know, so-and-so had big ears and they were so big, and he took tape and taped them to the side of his head. And then they laid back after many, many, many nights of sleeping with his ears taped back. I woke up the next morning with tape all over me except on my ears. I don't know how that happened, but the tape came off and it was wrapped around my nose and it was everywhere. And yet it didn't help. It took me many years to get over the big ears. But you know what? Not one time did my mother ever say to me, come here, big ears. You know, you'll never know what it is kids are sensitive about. Maybe it's red hair. Maybe they're sensitive about their red hair, or they're sensitive about their freckles, or they're sensitive because they're short, or they're sensitive because they're tall, or they're sensitive because they're well upholstered. Listen, kids can be sensitive over a number of things, but they don't need to be humiliated by the very people who should give them security. And you'll not help them if you make fun of those things that they can't help. Come here, Bucky. I knew a guy in high school. Everybody called him Bucky because he had buck teeth. Yeah, and if I'd have been that guy, I'd have hated everybody. He grew up not to hate everybody. I don't know how. If I'd have had big buck teeth and everybody to call me Bucky all the time that I was in high school, I'd have hated everybody. But then when your parents do it, you know, lots of times parents think that they'll actually change their child by making fun of them. I have to tell you, we had a problem with one of our children, and it's not any of my children here, just so you know. But we had a bedwetter. And it was a real problem. I mean, it was like second, third grade, and it wasn't any better. We tried everything. We tried bribing. Look, if you'll quit wetting the bed, we'll give you a watch. That's what Mother did to me. She said, if you'll quit wetting the bed, we'll give you a watch. By the way, that's part of the story I'll come back to in a minute. So we tried giving him. He didn't care. He couldn't tell time anyway. He said, didn't do anything. So I said, okay, you know what? Evidently, if you don't care about this, I need to make you care. So every morning you wake up wet, you're going to get a whooping. I tried giving him a whoop. That didn't help. Somebody told us about a little electric thing that you put underneath him. Now, this doesn't make sense to me at all. An electric thing you're going to put under a bedwetting child. But it was supposed to be an alarm. And whenever water hit this, it was supposed to go beep, 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 and wake the child up. Because the theory is that the child is a bedwetter because he sleeps too sound. But you know what? I got to the point, I was so desperate to try to help this child quit wetting the bed that I actually made fun of him. I'm ashamed to admit that to you now. But I actually would make fun of him. And one day I was sitting at my mother's house and talking to Mother, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do with such and such a child. I've tried everything. I've tried this, I've tried that, I've tried punishment, I've tried reward. I said, Elsie and I are at our wits' end. I don't know what we're going to do. And Mother said, well, Daniel, you wet the bed till you were in the fifth grade. You know, I'd forgotten that. Isn't it amazing how you and I forget? We had some of the very same problems when we were little. Isn't it terrible what old age does to you? You grow up and you forgot you couldn't sit still either. You forgot you had bad habits too. In a way, I'm glad not to remember all of those failures and flaws from my youth. But listen, you'd better remember that whatever your kids are going through, you went through it too. And you know, that gave me a whole new light on that child. And you know what? I remembered this night after night. I'd wake up and go over to Mother, and I'd tug on her sleeve in her bed, and I'd say, Mom, I did it again. And she'd get up, and she'd go put dry clothing on my bed, and she never, ever once scolded me, rebuked me. She never, ever once demeaned me and talked down to me. And when I remembered that, it broke my heart. Because I had really, really taken advantage of the situation and done wrong. This insulting speech, it wounds the child's self-image and their self-respect. Jesting about their defects. Here's another thing, number eight, reiterating faults and failures. This goes like this, reiterating faults and failures. There you go again. How many times have I told you not to play at the table? You knocked over another glass of tea. There you go again. How many times do we have to go through this? Well, listen, I'm just going to be honest with you, probably a thousand times. How many parents could testify to the fact that you've repeated the same thing a thousand times? I mean, honestly, between all your kids, you've gone over it and over it and over it and over it and over it. But you know what? There comes a point you need to forgive a child and let the child be. You need to let the offense die. This thing of reiterating faults and failures, just never letting them ever forget it. You know what the child is going to one day say? You know what? You know what? Why don't we just forget? One day the child will grow up and he'll be old enough, he'll look back in your eyes and he'll be able to talk back and he'll say what he's been wanting to say for the last 10 or 15 years. And he'll say, you know what? I never am going to satisfy you, so I'll pack my bags and I'm out of here. And you'll turn that child's heart against you if you can't learn to forgive. Listen, when a child does wrong, I'm probably the biggest spanker in this room. I spanked for offenses that I'm sure many of you would not have spanked for. But you know what? When a child is spanked, it's over. It should be finished. And by the way, the whole spanking, there's an art to that. You don't just grab a child up and spank him. You can make go sit on your bed. I want you to go sit on your bed and think about this. Let him sweat for a little while. Let him sit there and think about what they... Then when you go up there for the spanking, then rehearse to them. What did you do wrong? Why are you being spanked? Do you think I'm mad at you? Do you think I love you? Why do you think I'm spanking you? Because I love you too much to let you think you can live this way and God let you get by with it. I love you too much for that. And so I'm going to have to discipline you, but I don't want to. But you brought this on yourself. You bought and paid for this yourself. And after having that talk, and most of the time, by the time you get done talking, the kids are saying, could we just get on with the spanking? You know, I'd rather just get spanked than I would to have this lecture all the time. Yeah, but you're going to hear the lecture if you're going to get the paddling. We're going to do the whole thing. And then after the paddling's over, then sit down and hug them and love them and pray with them and ask God to forgive them and you forgive them. And then you know what? Let that be the end of it. Don't bring it up every time you turn around. Listen, that's good advice for any relationship. This constantly reiterating faults and failures is counterproductive. You know, lots of wives have thought they were going to change their husband by reiterating faults and failures. And they've been married 20 and 25 and 30 and 35 years and haven't changed him yet. As a matter of fact, every time the wife reiterates what she is aggravated about with her husband, he just sets it deeper in his mind. I'm not going to quit this until she quits nagging me. If I quit it then. It's counterproductive. It doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, then lose it. Unreasonable demands, unrealistic expectations, unfavorable comparison to other children, inconsistent behavior, discourteous speech, insulting speech, jesting about defects, reiterating faults and failures. Here's number 9, criticizing pursuits. This happens a lot when parents are trying to relive their life through their children. Some guys never got to play Little League Baseball, and so their boys are going to play it. And they're going to, in a vicarious sort of way, they're going to relive their life through their boys. I never played Little League Baseball. Now, I never made my boys. Stephen will tell you I made him, and I might have made him play for 1 year, but I didn't make him play as much as the other boys played. They wanted to play. He didn't care to play. Everybody played at least a year, but I really wasn't trying to relive my life through them, but I know parents that are. If you don't believe that, watch the parents on the sideline while their kids play. Huh? Watch them on the sideline. I was assistant coach for a couple of different years under a couple of different people and helped coach. And you could see in parents, certain parents were really trying to live 20 years longer in their kid. They were trying to teach their kid and impose upon their kid what they would have done if they were on the field playing. They were trying to use him kind of like a little robot and trying to maneuver him on the field for their pleasure. You know what? It wasn't even fun for most of those kids. What happens with this parent that wants to relive his life through his children is when his children take a different angle or a different course than he wanted them to take, he gets aggravated. Maybe their hobbies differ with his. Maybe they don't care about athletics and he loved athletics. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe he didn't love athletics at all and they loved athletics. My wife's dad Clyde Tate never cared for sports at all. If he walked into a room and a football game was on or a baseball game or any kind of sport, he would leave the room with a scowl on his face. It was an utter waste of time, not only to play the game, but it's double waste of time to sit there and watch it. And Grandpa just didn't care for sports at all. And you know, so this kind of a parent, if the child does something that doesn't meet with their approval, then they criticize their pursuits. Well, I don't know what you get out of that. I played with baseball cards. Now, my mother thought it was fine, but my dad would come home from work and he said, "What have you done all afternoon? You played with these baseball cards all afternoon?" "Yes, sir." "Well, boy, what a waste of time." He thought I should have been doing something else. Now, I never hated my dad for that, but listen, if you do it enough, you can cause a child to be provoked to wrath, criticizing their pursuits. Sometimes a child likes things you don't like. Maybe they like art and they're wanting to draw pictures, and to you that's an utter waste of time. You'd rather see them go to the garden and pull weeds. Well, that's not practical for us. We're farm people. And here you are inside coloring pictures and painting pictures. I don't get that at all. And you view that as lazy when in fact the child is just different. And if you criticize their pursuits, you can drive them and provoke them to wrath. Number 10, scorning their friends. Now this is getting really serious. You need to listen to this. You need to understand whose children's friends are. Children's friends mirror who they see themselves to be. In other words, children pick friends that they think are like them. We can take kids to camp, and when we unload the van of kids or the bus of kids, and when all the other churches arrive, within 30 minutes, all of the pairs are all, they're all paired up. Kids who are a little rebellious, they're all standing in a cluster. Kids that are athletic, they're all standing in a cluster. Kids that are the Bible thumpers, they're all standing in a cluster. Kids that are a little on the backward side, they're standing together. And they pick out other kids that they see to be like themselves. Now, you need to understand that before you go criticizing their friends, because when you criticize their friends, you're criticizing your children. You don't realize that. You see your children as different than those other kids. But that's not how they see it. Scorning friends. This is excessive companionship with peers. And this excessive companionship with peers signals failure in a relationship at home. You know, it would trouble me if my kids would rather be down at the end of the street under the streetlight hanging with a gang of thugs than they would at home in the living room with dad and mother. Now, I shouldn't be mad at the child over that. I ought to be looking at myself and saying, where did I fail here? Something is wrong here that they'd rather be down there with them than with me. You know, and it doesn't have to just be me. It can be any godly Christian. Daniel loved Art Dunlap. And Art Dunlap had huge impact on Daniel's life. And I've seen this happen when we lived here in town. Daniel would be in the yard playing a pickup game of football with 8, 10, 12 kids. And if Art pulled his pickup in the driveway and tooted the horn, Daniel dropped that crowd like they were hot potatoes and ran to see what Art wanted. You know what? He had made friends with a godly individual, and that was more valuable to him than those peers. Now listen, I'm not against kids having friends, but if they'd rather be with the friends than with dad and mother, or if they'd rather be with the friends than they would other mature Christians, then you should understand there's a problem. But the problem's not the child's. The problem is yours, as parents. Parents have made them to believe they are who they are, and so we need to be careful about scorning their friends. They will be provoked to wrath by that. Number 11, needlessly interfering with plans or enjoyments, imposing fruitless sacrifices. Here's a child that wants to go spend a night with a good family in the church, and you don't want them to go, really, because maybe you don't want to drive across town, or maybe you had other plans. Maybe you just want them home that night. But the child has looked forward to it and looked forward to it and looked forward to it. And at the last minute, you create some reason why the child can't go. Making those fruitless sacrifices, well, you're just not going to be able to do it. Making that fruitless sacrifice will cause the child to, imposing that fruitless sacrifice will cause the child eventually to be driven to wrath. Here's the 13th thing. The 12th thing, I'm sorry, breaking promises. Proverbs 13:12 says, hope deferred maketh the heart sick, but when the desire cometh, it is a tree of life. You know, this is probably one of the easiest things to slide into, especially if you're not your own boss. But even when you are your own boss, you can slide into this before you know it. You tell your son, you know what, we'll go fishing on Saturday. Friday night, the boss says, I need you to work tomorrow. Well, obviously, you know where your bread is buttered. So you go home and tell the boy, there won't be a fishing trip tomorrow because I've got to work. Now, one time, you know what? The child is okay with that one time. Maybe even two times. But if week after week after week, that becomes the habit and the practice and the norm, that week after week you're breaking promises, do you know what the Bible says? It's better not to make a vow than to make a vow and break it. And that's true with the Lord, and it's true with little children. When you make promises to your kids, you had better dead sure keep them. Because soon what will happen to the child is he will measure your promise, and he'll say, you know what, I can't believe what Dad says about his promises, so how do I know what he says about the Bible is true either? How do I know what he says about life is true? Nothing Dad says is true. And he begins to see you as an unreliable source in his life. And when that happens, you don't want that to happen. And that brings us to the last thing, number 13, and that's compensating for failure with material things. Here's what happens to that father who promised his child, we'll go fishing on Saturday, and the child is gravely disappointed. And Dad thinks, well, you know what, I worked overtime, I made $300 extra dollars working overtime on Saturday, I'll buy the kid a new bike. You know what, the kid doesn't want a new bike, he wants Dad. He wants your word to be kept. He doesn't. Once you start trying to buy off your failures, you'll create a monster. One day you won't be able to afford the ante. You know, I see mothers do this in the grocery store. Honey, now you be good, and mommy will buy you a candy bar. You know, I'm not going to tell you we never rewarded our kids when they were good in the store, but we rewarded them because we wanted to after the desired behavior had been given. But I don't remember once that we ever bribed the children and said, if you'll be good, then we'll buy you this. Because see, what'll happen is when they're five, a candy bar will be just fine, but it won't be when they're nine. When they're nine, it's going to have to be a McDonald's Happy Meal. And when they're 12, it's going to be a new pair of tennis shoes. And when they're 15, it's going to be some computerized gadget. And by the time they're 18, you won't be able to afford what it is that you're going to have to buy them off with. It's better to keep your word. And it's better to give that child your time and your attention. And you say, well, preacher, I never can guess what my work is going to do. Then don't make promises. Just don't make promises. Don't make promises if you can't keep it. But when you make a promise, you'd better dead sure know you can keep it, and you're willing to cross any bridge to make it happen. I made my promise. It will happen. If I have to take off work, it will happen. But be careful about making promises that you don't keep. And then when you do break a promise, be careful about compensating for failure with material things. You know what you'll end up with? You'll end up making a materialist out of your child. You'll end up making that child love things instead of people. If you spend your life compensating with that child material things for every one of your failures, you will train him to love things and not people. And that's a huge mistake. Number one, you want him to love Dad and Mother. Number two, you want him to love his brothers and sisters. Someday, you want him to marry a wife and love her like dad loves his wife. But you can actually raise a child that's incapable of loving anything but themselves and the things that they can possess. But most people aren't born that way. They're trained. And it's dads and mothers that train them by giving them too many things. I hate to say this, but most kids, including mine, have too many things. I mean, when they were home as children. If you got more things than you can put away at night when you go to bed, it's a problem. Now, that brings our message this evening to a close. All of this adds up to this one thing. I do not want to be a failure as a vice regent of the Lord Jesus Christ. I don't want to do anything. You know, it's hard enough to get children to have the right attitude, to grow up and to believe the right things and love the right things and stand for the right things and have the right character without me doing things that drive them farther away. And so my hope tonight in bringing this message is that as a parent, this is not to say your child will be, if you don't make any of these mistakes, it's not to say your child will be perfect. You're still going to have to battle Adam's sinful flesh. Because believe me, there's plenty of Adam in every child. There's plenty of selfishness. There's plenty of pride. There's plenty of greed. There's plenty of other bad virtues and vices that are in every child that you're going to have to deal with without me as a parent making problems worse by provoking them to wrath. Do you understand? And so let's be careful as parents on our part that we don't do things to make matters worse, because you still got an uphill battle to raise children. Raising kids, I think, is the hardest thing on the planet. And boy, if God blesses you in it and you raise some decent and godly kids, then you just better be grateful. Don't be proud of it, because you didn't do it by yourself. God did it through you, and God did it in spite of you. And you know, God, many times, I've never understood why so many failures I've had as a father, so many failures, and yet my children chose to look past the failures and to believe the right and do the right and chose to serve the Lord regardless of my temper, regardless of my tongue, regardless of the times that I have been vocally rude to them and overbearing to them. My children still love me. I don't know why. I can only say I'm grateful. I praise the Lord for His grace and His mercy. But dads and moms, let's not make the problem worse. Let's just focus on the problem and begin to look at parenting. I love this out of one book that I read. It really helps us when we learn that parenting is really discipleship. That's what it is. Parenting is making a disciple. It's not just raising a child that won't grow up and embarrass us one day. It is actually making a disciple for Jesus Christ. That should be our goal. I pray that that's yours. Would you bow with me, please, for prayer?